Netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney, you're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
FX Guide is proudly sponsored by SIGGRAPH Asia. FX Podcast is the official podcast of SIGGRAPH Asia, this year being held in Hong Kong, December 12th to 15th. For more information, go to siggraph.org/asia2011.
Thanks for joining us for this FX Podcast. I'm joined on the line by Mike Seymour.
Hey, Jeff, how are you?
Very good, thanks. About to head off to IBC. You're just recently back from SIGGRAPH.
I thank the Lord that I do not need to travel this week, my friend.
Oh, yeah, I'll bet.
Hey, we've got a really good FX podcast for you guys this week, but I guess I was keen to join you, if I could, for your intro, Jeff, just because I thought it'd be good to kind of set up what this week's about.
Yeah, I really need to understand more. I mean, I get that we're talking about computational photography, and this was something you recorded at SIGGRAPH, right? Or right after SIGGRAPH?
No, actually, no. This is something I recorded just 2 days ago, but it's interestingly related to SIGGRAPH because we're going to be speaking to Carrie Pulley, who is the NVIDIA Senior Director of Research into this area of computational photography for NVIDIA. He used to be at Nokia, and he's going to be giving a computational photography presentation at SIGGRAPH Asia.
Oh, that's right, SIGGRAPH Asia, right. Now, so just in a brief nutshell, can you describe for people what computational photography means?
Sure. I mean, we're going to, in the interview, discuss a lot of stuff, but the idea is nothing to do with specifically mobile platforms, but it's just the idea of overcoming the limitation of a camera. How can I do things computationally to overcome the limitation of a normal camera? Could I like combine images, adjust images, do funky stuff? And in the early days, this evolved into a research project at Stanford, and primarily Stanford. It's expanded since then. And at the early days, they built this thing that they called the Franken camera, as in like Frankenstein's monster. It was a sort of a, not a cobbled together, but it was definitely a hand-built kind of thing. And the Franken camera 2, which is the one that a lot of the research has been done on, had a very, very small lens and sensor in it. In fact, that which you would find in, say, a phone. And Nokia got involved, and they have the 900, which is a Nokia camera that also they allowed you to do similar things to. And this became the development platform for this whole area of work we call computational photography.
Hmm. Very cool. So what, I mean, this is all kind of research at this point, but we're thinking that this will start eventually, as all these things do, hopefully evolving into things that will be useful to us.
Well, look, as we discuss in the interview you're about to hear, I'm really enthusiastic about this because there's no reason that this should be devoted to cell phones, though I'll give you some stats that might show you why it's of particular interest to cell phones. There were about 85 million camera phones in 2003, and that by this year's got up to 800 million. And sort of 65% of phones right now have a reasonable camera in them. But by 4 years hence, 3 years from now, 2014, that's going to grow to about 1.3 billion. Pocket cameras in phones, and they've gone from being 1 megapixel, 2 megapixel, up to mainly now about 15% of the market is a 5 megapixel camera, and by the next 2 or 3 years, that'll be about half the market will be 5 megapixel cameras. So when you've got a 5 megapixel camera and 1.3 billion of them out there, if you can come up with some clever things to make better photos, that's of a lot of interest. And obviously that growth in cameras is vastly dwarfing the growth in, say, SLRs for obvious reasons. Now, that being said, the F3, as in the FCam 3, the Franken camera's next generation, which they're just calling the FCam 3, that's going to have a full 2048 by 2048, you know, proper what you might consider SLR chip in it. So if we've seen all this growth in computational photography based on the F2, the Franken camera 2, and the work that Nokia was doing, all with these tiny chips and tiny sensors. Maybe, just maybe, if we went to a bigger format like the SLRs that you and I both use, Jeff, we could see an explosion in computational photography for SLRs, and that would be mind-expanding.
Right, exciting. Cool. Yeah, I mean, it is funny, just a normal cell phone, an iPhone. I walked into an office today, and one of the guys was doing a time lapse on his iPhone of just some work he was doing, and it was kind of interesting. And I was thinking about how many I had listened to the podcast recording, and I was thinking about just how many ways we use cell phone cameras now that we wouldn't have thought of when they first put them in there, you know, with the pan around tile type stuff and the HDR, even as limited as it is in the cell phones, you know, it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, look, and I mean, the other thing is, while we all know that an SLR has an incredibly superior lens and sensor to a camera phone, camera phones have some pretty good little computers in there that you can program, as opposed to my, well, Canon, really. I can't get in my Canon's onboard processor and write any C++ for it. But, you know, the...
Sure. And even the Technicolor guys had said how difficult it was to get access to the things they wanted to get access to.
Yeah, absolutely.
And they were trying to do their LUT, you know, the cinema style.
But this program, this whole computational photography thing, this is not a proprietary thing. This is something that's really exploding with a lot of companies. So this new project has been expanded. So it was Stanford and Nokia, and they're still involved. But now Adobe, Kodak, Sony, HP, Disney, Intel, Texas Instruments, Google, NVIDIA, and Sony are all on board. Now, that's a pretty decent set of people.
Yeah.
So I'm sort of sticking my neck out here, and I'm saying, look, if this goes the way that I think it will, then we'll maybe look back in this podcast in 5 years' time as being a real turning point when we saw that move from computational photography at the cell phone level, because it was cheap and cheery and easy and accessible, to the level that it's being used at SLRs. And I should point out that this is more than just wishful thinking. Like any university in America under an American grant system can get a free F3 camera and kit and development code environment, because there's an entire grant that's been set up by the US government to promote this kind of research in America. So this should see this sort of work spreading out across the major universities in the US, all at that SLR level. And I don't have a dig at Nokia, because I think Nokia's done a terrific job. I've got nothing but praise for them. But When they did the first round of this, they only had the little one. So they got, and I kind of touched on this in the story, but I didn't go into it in too much detail. But imagine, if you will, that you're a Stanford University lecturer and all you have is the Franken camera, the F2, and then now you've got it running on the Nokia 900. So what they said to the members of the class, of the lecture, of the Stanford thing is, hey, why don't you take all these 900s and do something as this week's assignment? You've got a week. And then what are we going to do with it? Well, why don't you see if you could improve the autofocus algorithm that the Nokia engineers spent the last, you know, X number of years coming up with in a week. And within a week, most of the class had matched or bettered by 50% or 100%, people want to look at it, what Nokia had taken several years to develop in terms of autofocus. And that's what excites me. Because if you suddenly distribute these F3s around the country and have really good researchers all working on it, I just think the sky's the limit. It could just be one of those great moments of exploding kind of innovation. And I've got to say, this is like this is iPhone apps at its best. This is people coming up with really clever stuff.
Well, you're also opening it up to people. I have to say that in the camera world, and it's not knocking them, but there's certain vested interests involved in some of the camera companies that have to protect kind of their markets the way they're going, you know?
This is a disruptive technology. You're absolutely right. Like, you know, you're seeing amazing stuff coming out of cameras that have no business in producing images this good. Some of it's gimmicky, I grant you, but some of it is really cool. And I've got to tell you, a lot of it is just left to field ideas that just didn't even occur to me. And when somebody does it, you go, oh, of course, that's brilliant. So
very cool.
Anyway.
All right, so who are we talking to again?
So this is the now the NVIDIA's Senior Director of Research, Carrie Pulley. And he's a doctor, Dr. Pulley, and we'll cross to him now.
Yeah, so mobile phones have a couple of things. First of all, most of them have the cameras. Then they are kind of easier programming platforms than regular cameras, so they are kind of general-purpose computers nowadays. So you can try new things on them. And finally, there are these challenges that the cameras are kind of smaller than the real big cameras. The optics is smaller, the sensor is smaller, so that means challenges. So you can try to improve the images by taking several images and combining them in some interesting ways, and that's computational photography.
It's a pretty interesting area, isn't it? Because while the handheld, like my cell phone, for example, does have obviously a really small sensor by comparison to my Canon 5D, my Canon 5D doesn't have a very good user interface, or for that matter, onboard general purpose kind of computer to do anything with those images. It basically just processes them. Where if we look at, say, I don't know, the Nokia, which is obviously the Nokia 900, has been, you know, very much at the center of this. That has a fairly general purpose onboard. That's what it's the OMAP 3430, is that right? In the Nokia 900?
Yeah, I think that's the CPU. Or that's the common chip.
And they're kind of comparable with, I guess, the A4s in the Apple iPhones. Though in the case of this area, it actually matters quite a lot the access that the programmer gets to them, because while the chips might be comparable between my iPhone and a Nokia 900, in fact, Nokia are sort of more aware, I guess, or more open in allowing programming at the chip, which is one thing, and obviously at the camera part of the phone at another. And that's really pivotal, isn't it?
Yeah, so the Nokia N900, that was quite interesting and fairly unique handset or smartphone, that it's really the most open smartphone that I've seen. Most of the software was released in open source by Nokia for that device. Also, TI, that provided the hardware for it, they published lots of the specs. So it was possible even for third parties to generate something, create the new camera API that actually accesses the hardware at really low level. Most smartphones, most cell phones are not as open for several reasons. Even if they might, if the OS might be like Android phones, and Android operating system is open, but typically the phones that you buy, they have been protected much more.
And this is all related to work that was done also with Stanford because of the Franken camera. I love that name, the Franken camera project. And I think that went in about July of last year. They released the source code for the Franken camera API, but also on the Nokia 900. Now, could you discuss that? Because the Franken camera is an actual camera, but it's also a kind of a philosophy on computational photography.
Yeah. So Franken camera, well, I guess originally the name of the project that we had while I was still at Nokia, we had this joint project with Stanford, and we just wanted to see how to do computational photography on cell phones. And we had lots of difficulties because the APIs were not expressive enough for us to control the camera at the level that we wanted. And we basically ended up creating a new API and implementing it both on this kind of prototype camera that was built at Stanford and the Nokia N900 device that was built by Nokia. But they shared lots of both software and hardware. Both were based on Linux, and both used the same OMAP 3430 TI chip. And then we came up with the API. It's, you could say that its name's FCAM. You can say it's short for Franken camera. It's just easier to type when you're coding. But also you could say that it's the functional camera, a flexible camera, because that's what it really, it flexibly brings the functionality of the camera hardware and makes it available for application developers, programmers. And that's what FCAM is all about.
Okay, so the actual FCAM 2, which I saw at SIDGRAPH 2010, was a camera that's quite bulky. It's not particularly pretty, but it's in its core, it had pretty much similar stuff to an N900 in the sense that it had a small, very small actually, sensor. Now there's an F3 coming out, which I think is going to be out relatively soon, which actually has sort of more like a sort of a classic CMOS large sensor. In fact, I think dramatically bigger than the one that the F2 had. Is that right?
Yes. So the idea was actually Stanford and MIT, they applied for NSF grant National Science Foundation grant to create courseware for computational photography. And the idea was that they would give out slideware, so basically teaching material, but also this version 3 of Franken camera devices to universities within the U.S. And also Nokia pledged to loan out some FCAM capable devices for the homeworks. And indeed, the F3 brings much better sensor. It's basically full-size sensor, the same kind of sensor as you have on your digital SLRs, which is also a better match to the sensor. Already the version 2 of Franken camera did accept and does accept Canon lenses, so full-size lenses, but since the sensor is the small cell phone sensor, same, it's basically a size of your other nail in your smallest finger, then the optics is not very very good match to this sensor, and you kind of waste lots of the capabilities of the optics. But in the next upcoming F3 version, they are good match.
Well, do you know when the F3 is coming out?
I don't know. It was supposed to come late last spring, but there's been delays. I hope it'll come out this fall, but I can't tell more precisely.
And as I understand it, the specs on that, it's got like a 2048 by 2048 kind of 4-megapixel chip, but it also is going to run 15 frames a second at full res. Do you know if it has a global shutter or not, or is it a rolling shutter? I mean, CMOS, you imagine it might be a rolling shutter.
There's at least no physical shutter, so okay. It's rolling shutter.
So that's the F3, obviously the work with Nokia, but the actual camera project, this kind of area of expertise, has actually got a lot of buy-in now from a lot of companies. In fact, I think there was additional funding thrown in by like Adobe, Kodak, Sony, Disney, TI, and of course NVIDIA, where you're now at, has an interest in this, doesn't it?
Right, yeah. So I moved from Nokia to NVIDIA this spring, and the first thing I started working on is FCAM. So NVIDIA has its own line of system on chips, mobile chips that run power smartphones and tablets. That's called Tegra. And we are porting, my team is porting FCAM running on Tegra. And it's basically running, it's functionally complete. I still have some polishing to do, but you can already run pretty much the same applications that you could on F2 or N900.
One of the reasons I really find the whole FCAM project so interesting is because it's been so open in the sense that it's been done with Stanford and stuff. There's some great ideas and things that have come up from... So it almost sort of defies the logic of what you should be able to do with a small sensor camera in a phone. In fact, I laughed when I think I heard a speech you gave where they were saying that they gave a bunch of Stanford grads the N900 for about a week, and several of them, if not many of them, actually matched or bettered Nokia's autofocus times in a week. So this idea of having like the community contributing certainly means that we're seeing a lot of innovation in this area. I was wondering if we could talk about some of those sorts of things that are sort of, I guess, applications that are being harnessing the chips but also harnessing the optics. And I guess the first one of those would be things like HDR, like a higher dynamic range, because we wouldn't really associate a higher dynamic range with a cell phone camera. But that's something, of course, you know, my mum would like. She'd like it to be able to take photos where she had a lot of latitude in the shot because, you know, they tend to be very much point and shoot. What are the kind of approaches to solving some of these problems?
Yeah, HDR is kind of prototypical computational photography application. The idea being is that the camera can't often take a good image, meaning similar image as you would experience it with your own eyes. If there's some bright spot, it saturates and you only see white. If there's a dark corner in the room, it looks completely black and noisy. But if you take several images with different exposure settings so that the one image is kind of exposed to dark areas of the image, and another image is for the midtones, and yet another image for the bright areas, you kind of collect the information that's available, the visual information of amount of the light that comes to the camera from all parts of the scene. And then you can combine them into a single image that basically shows you the details from all of these areas, and it's just more visually pleasing. So this was also one of the first applications that we implemented on FCAM. And we released, so if you're lucky enough to have one of these N900s and it's available, its HDR application is available as a free download for you to try it on your device. And there are actually several ways of doing HDR imaging. We kind of chose a simple way. It's called exposure fusion, where we don't really do like physical measurements of the light, but we have heuristics to figure out which parts of the images or various input images look good, and then we combine the parts that look the best into a single image.
I was going to say, because that's the thing, it isn't really in the case, because when I'm doing HDRs on a Canon, I'm bracketing, you know, a lot of exposures, and I'm trying to get something that's calibrated to the sensor and get a really accurate sense of it. But what you're more interested in, I guess, than the HDR per se, is the tone-mapped output of that HDR. And it's that getting a good tone mapping that kind of would make it a useful thing in this particular environment. I guess that and quick, because you need a lot of feedback probably on the camera to the user.
Yeah, it's that's kind of the computational photography of the past is that people do it on the labs. You have some high-end camera, you use tripod, you might have like still life scene, and then you process the images later on some big PC. We wanted to kind of liberate the users from all of this. We wanted to give the users the instant gratification of seeing the end result right away. And that means that you shouldn't have to wait a long time for the output images. Now, when we created this first HDR application, it's a fair amount of processing that you have to do, and the cell phones are not quite as capable as desktop PCs. So we have to innovate on the algorithms, try to find reasonable shortcuts in terms of processing, but shortcuts that don't give up the quality. And then you can try to hide the delay of the images. So what we did in this HDR application is that we calculated the preview at the screen resolution of the image, and this we could show to the user within a couple of seconds after the capture. While the user is still kind of looking at the image, the processor in the background is still computing the high-resolution version, and this way, something that takes like a minute to process appears to only take a couple of seconds.
Because there seems to me three things at play here. There's the fact that, I guess, what, about 15% now of the market have 5-megapixel actual sort of cameras, in the phone. So that's grown a lot, obviously, since the days of just 1 or 2 megapixels. But also, we've got these chips in there, which are, let's face it, you know, single core. They're fine. They're great in the phones, but they're not really sort of super computationally fast compared to what obviously we'd have in a laptop or a tower. And then you've got the issue of just how small the sensor is and low light sensitivity. And I was wondering, in those three areas, in terms of sort of sensitivity or dynamic range of the actual sensor, the size of the sensor, and for that matter the optics, and the power of the computer, is any one of those three, you think, sort of holding back or the restriction on computational photography, or is it just an axis of all three growing over time?
I think it's kind of axis of all three. In the mobile devices, usually power is the big delimiter. There's limit how much computation you can put on the device that's small. One part of it is that the batteries are small, and if you just do lots of computation, then your battery runs out soon and the users are not happy. Another component is that even if you had enough power, it's still physically small. So if you would run a kind of PC-level processor on that small space, it would soon just burn out and fry and, well, be too hot to handle. Then there's other limitations. There's physical size. People kind of like their pocketable devices at sizes that can fit in the pockets, and that should be kind of slim and nice looking. And that means that you can't put very high quality cameras into something that should be smaller than 1 centimeter thick, or even like 5 millimeters thick or something. So there are several dimensions.
And so obviously we get to this thing that you talked about with the HDR, which is this idea of a burst mode or a multi-exposure or multi-shot solution. So there's a bunch of things. Maybe you could talk about some of those sorts of things, because there's things like, for example, the painted aperture, the idea of trying to get a shallow depth of field from taking multiple shots, or just a really deep or all-focusing solution, which again is sort of normally a burst solution. So there's quite a lot of solutions related to, okay, I can't do it in one shot, let me do it in multiple shots. And I guess there, the interval between shots becomes critical.
Yes, so especially if you are, if you have a scene where things move, for example, people, they usually are not still while you try to take images. So you need to take the images fast so that things don't move too much. If they move too much, it's very difficult to deal with that. If things are still, things get easier. So these applications that take a burst of images, they usually vary some parameter and then combine. So you mentioned this all focus images and kind of narrow field of depth images. So if you have a bigger camera, there's usually some area of the image that's sharp. And the same works with your own eyes. If you focus on something, you see that part of the sharply, and things that are closer or further away, they are blurry. And that actually is a very good effect. People use it, for example, in portrait photography. You want the target person to be sharp and the irrelevant background to be blurry. Now, this is difficult to do if your camera is very small, like they are in the cell phone camera. So, indeed, there has been this Professor Mark Levoy implemented a synth cam where you move the camera and you kind of take images and then you align the images on those parts that should remain sharp and then kind of blur the other parts, and you simulate this effect that you can achieve in larger cameras. On the other hand, sometimes people want to see everything sharp, and physical cameras don't just produce images that where everything is sharp. So then you can take the other approach where you take images that are focused at different distances, then you analyze each pixel, which of the input images is sharpest, and then you compose one image where everything is sharp. So it kind of depends what kind of effect you want to create. And this taking several images and adding some computation, those then are part of your palette or tools to allow you to achieve the artistic effect that you are after.
So what we've been discussing here, you know, centered around mobile computing and to mobile cameras, I mean, a lot of this is also applicable, I would have thought, to larger format cameras. I mean, there's a bunch of stuff that you could do that, because a lot of this stuff in terms of the multiple exposures even ends up with pattern matching to be able to align or stitch or connect. It's interesting, though, most of the computational papers that we've seen at SIGGRAPH and stuff do tend to be in mobile computing areas. Do you think there's a lot of applicability for this work to sort of larger SLRs?
Yes. That's kind of what the Franken camera version 3 is trying to be. It's trying to be a big camera that's flexible. The thing is that the traditional camera makers, they kind of have a reputation to protect. They have very high quality, and they have kind of ideas what kind of images look like their brand kind of promises. And they are somewhat reluctant to open up the software stacks or their cameras to third parties, because what might happen is that somebody creates these plugins or algorithms that are not to the quality level that the manufacturer wants to guarantee. So this means that all the innovation has to happen within a single company. And now our idea with the FCAM API and open sourcing it and making it available to everybody, both consumers and researchers and different companies, is to open up the development of the algorithms so that everybody can innovate, everybody can prototype their new algorithms. They might not run quite as efficiently as if they were programmed in the firmware or the device when it's shipping, but at least it's very flexible and you can experiment on different kind of approaches. And then when one of those new approaches kind of proves themselves and seems to be popular, then the manufacturers can optimize that in their own ways and implement also that kind of functionality in their kind of shipping cameras.
I think one of the other things that's really fascinating about this, because it's ended up with these mobile devices, is that they have stuff that my big Canon or Nikon doesn't have. And one of the things they have is a gyro. And there have been a bunch of interesting actual sort of applications here that have taken advantage of that. For example, I'm thinking of one where it was like, well, you're trying to take a stable photo. So literally that you press the button and then the gyro just waits until it believes the camera is stable and then it actually takes the picture, which I think is just kind of indicative of this, like coming up with things outside the box that can take advantage of stuff that literally aren't in SLR cameras.
Yeah, that's an example that somebody who's making a kind of product decision might think that it's kind of silly application, or maybe it's not silly. It's something that there isn't kind of proven demand yet, so they would not implement it. But if you open up the system, then students can come up with this kind of creative and innovative applications, and they actually prove up to be useful.
I think the other thing is that these cameras aren't very expensive. I mean, relatively speaking, obviously like an iPhone or a Nokia or whatever aren't dead cheap, but they're still relatively a lot cheaper than a major SLR. And so you get sort of multiple camera solutions as well. I loved the one that somebody came up with, which was just Bluetoothing between cameras to have the flash in a different camera used as the flash for, say, my camera, because you can afford to have a few cameras around, and that would give you a much sort of obviously more creatively interesting lighting setup than just doing a flash from what must be right beside the lens on a normal kind of cell phone.
Yeah, cell phones indeed, they provide this connectivity that's typically not available on traditional cameras, and this enables new applications, for example, this borrowed flash to avoid the red eye effect when the flash is too close to the camera. Other similar applications, you could imagine that if there are events where lots of people are taking images, like a concert or a sports event or an accident or a wedding, where you'd like to make some kind of record, and then the fact that the cameras can communicate with each other can help you to create a much better record of the event.
And interestingly, in that particular respect, most people don't bother setting the time correctly on their SLR cameras because, it's not life or death to them. Obviously, professional photographers do. But, most cell phones actually have exactly the right time because they're getting a feed from the cell company. And quite frankly, people want to know what the time is, so they look at their phone, and so they bother having the clock set correctly. So you can actually get synchronization between cameras kind of more easily as well, just because you've sort of taken out the we require you all to bother playing with your user interface to make sure your clocks are the same kind of step. There's actually quite a few advantages, aren't there?
Yeah, especially if you're vacationing outside of your own time zone, what happens? I never remember to set the time zone correctly on my regular cameras, but on cell phone it just magically works.
Yeah. So, in fact, it may seem like some of these things, it's like, well, why am I struggling with a low light sensitivity, very small optics? But in fact, you're getting a lot of really interesting stuff. And as the apps have started developing over the last few years on these phones, we've seen that there's a real interest in being able to process. I mean, for example, just normal photographic processing applications that are running on these phones to make things look like they're old-fashioned or sepia or whatever. None of this is stuff that's available on traditional cameras. I wonder whether you'd like to comment, whether do you think that the F3 may lead to a large-scale, because I can imagine that a large-scale SLR flexible thing with a decent chip in it could be a really innovative camera. I mean, if you can do this with a cell phone, what could you do with an SLR that had the same kind of power?
So the kind of points that you made, that this kind of making your images actually like retro, old-fashioned, these kind of things, all of that you could do with traditional cameras, but it's just not easy. So yeah. What it means that you have to take the images first, and then you need to upload them to your PC, then you have to fire up some software to process them, and then yet another piece of software to kind of share them with your friends. And what's nice with smartphones is that everything happens on the same device. And you can, while you're still interested on the device, on the image, you can process it and you can immediately share it. So I would say this is the biggest kind of difference. It's how you use it. As they say, like, what's the best camera? And then, oh, it's my big SLR that has 500 millimeter lens. Well, the best camera is the one that you have with you when the interesting things happens, and that's a cell phone.
Yeah, I mean, there's I heard a statistic about 70% of phones now actually have a decent camera in them, or at least a camera that, you know, you could qualify for doing this kind of work, though not many of those phones have access to the camera tech, if you like, from an API sense to allow someone to develop some stuff. Can I ask you this, though? Because I really enjoyed the SIDGRAPH 2010 sessions on computational photography, but this year in Vancouver at SIDGRAPH, didn't really see much computational photography. But you're actually going to be talking at SIDGRAPH Asia, which I was really happy to see. Can you tell me what the course is going to be in Hong Kong?
So the course will be half-day course about FCAM, and we kind of start explaining what the computational photography is, and then we tell what the mobile computational photography is and what kind of challenges there are. And then we kind of describe the FCAM project and the API, and also to give an idea what it's like to program with. It's a C++ API available for a couple of Nokia devices, soon for NVIDIA development platforms, and this experimental camera, FCAM. The Franken camera version 2 and 3. We also will describe some of the algorithms and applications that we have discussed already, like HDR, low light imaging, and so forth, and also give ideas of the kind of algorithmic side, what kind of algorithms you need to create your own camera application.
Well, I once heard someone say that if you want to see the future, don't expect it to suddenly come out of nowhere. It normally comes out of the research lab. So if you want to just see what's going to be on your desk in 5 years, just see what's on the lab desk now. And I guess for me, this is exactly what I hope to see out of the computational photography, and especially with the F3 project, because as I said, if you can do all of this with a small cell phone camera, the idea of what you'll be able to do with the F3 and the approaches that the whole FCAM has led to, and this idea of, as I said, of like the way that the community is just coming up with these great innovative think outside the box solutions. I'm certainly really looking forward to your session in Hong Kong. Do we actually know yet when you're talking in Hong Kong, or have they not published actually which day it is?
I can't recall whether it's published. It's probably the first or second day of the conference, but I don't think they even told me which day I have to be there.
Well, I think the name of it is FCAM, Architecture and API for Computational Cameras. So if we've got that, we'll publish it. Otherwise, obviously, if someone's going to Hong Kong, good idea to put that out. And then over at NVIDIA, you've also presumably going to be publishing more stuff moving forward, because you're obviously setting up new work there as we speak.
Yes, we actually, at some conferences this summer, we kind of announced this program for researchers. If you have a research idea for mobile computational photography, please submit that idea at the research.nvidia.com website, and you might win one of those developer platforms that run FCAM. So we have already had lots of interest on that, and the competition is kind of still open, so if people are interested, it's still possible to get one of these developer boards.
Well, Dr. Pauly, thank you so much for taking time to talk to us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Well, thanks for that, Mike. That was really great.
Yeah, look, it's a tremendous... Look, I know you can geek out a bit with these things, but I've just been tracking, as I know John has, I don't know if you have the chips and stuff behind the scenes, and watching the move, for example, from the iPad to the iPhone, because the initial chips that Apple came out with, for example, for the iPads were like three times as expensive as the ones that are in the iPhone, but they get the yields down, they come over. And I just think that this whole idea of having this kind of computational power in a camera, you know, literally taking the sort of power that we're seeing of an iPad or an iPhone current generation, combine that with a much bigger sensor like an SLR has, and wow, if you've got some good minds on that, you can really do some good stuff. And there's one thing we didn't discuss in this, which is also important, which he's going to discuss in this SIGGRAPH presentation, is the very notion of how you think of a camera. This idea of it being just you have some settings and you take a still isn't really how these things kind of work. It's much more of a like a pipeline of configuring it and dealing with grain and zoom and reading that information out and formatting it and demosaicing it and color correcting, but all happening while the next one's coming down the line, because this is much more kind of a video mentality than a stills mentality. And so if you're interested in this stuff and how to run the stills camera in that kind of way, that's a lot of the stuff he's going to be covering at the presentation in Hong Kong.
Well, it's, you know, we think about things like, you know, the current RED technology and 5K and, you know, 200 frames a second on a in 2K on a camera like that, and it just seems like we're heading toward another wave of revolution in imagery, and it's exciting. I know, you know, all of us are so into images and shooting stuff that it's exciting to see what happens next.
Yeah, and you know, it is really important to our post pipelines that we understand what's happening at the cameras, and also a lot of this stuff is really innovative ways of dealing with imagery, which, whether it's on the camera or it's feeding from the camera into what we're doing in post, I think it is a really good idea to keep your eye on this stuff. So obviously, every week we're not going to be looking at computational photography, but I've got to confess, as I know you are a huge photographer, you've certainly taught me a few things, that it's great fun to sort of do this stuff.
Yeah, I'm excited to see what happens next. And, you know, we're by the time this comes out, we'll be at IBC, so we'll be seeing what's going on there. I know there's... sometimes IBC can not be a big announcement show, but I know there's at least one that people should be looking out for. We should be able to announce that right around the time this podcast comes out. So check out coverage over on FX Guide to see about that.
Well, that'll be on FX Guide TV, that particular announcement. I know the one you're talking about, but I'm also embargoed with you, but I won't be with you. And you're going to be at IBC having a great time, and I'll be here holding the fort.
Yes. Well, I think that'll do it for this podcast. Thanks for joining us. John Montgomery's not with us on this one, but... for Mike Seymour, this is Jeff Huser. We'll see you on the next FX Podcast.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.